This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books Network channel, New Books in South Asian Studies. I am Kshitij Jain, a master's student at the University of Oxford, and today we have the pleasure of hosting Dr. Patrick Olliville, who will be discussing about his 2023 book, Ashoka, the Portrait of a Philosopher King, which is published by HarperCollins India under the Indian Life series. Dr. Patrick Olliville is the Professor Emeritus of Asian Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. He has also served as the chair of the Department of Asian Studies at the same university from 1994 till 2007. Dr. Olliville's research interests include the ancient Indian legal tradition of Dharma Shastra. He has translated and edited four early Dharma Sutras and prepared a critical edition of Manava Dharma Shastra, or the Law Code of Manu. Thank you very much, sir, for accepting our invitation and being here on New Books Network today. It's a great pleasure hosting you.
You're most welcome.
To begin with our discussion, I would request you to tell us a bit about your objectives behind writing this book, and how do you think this book will add new dimensions to the ongoing historical discourse on Ashoka?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. So the book started out with an invitation from Professor Ramachandra Guha to contribute a biography of Ashoka for his ongoing series on Indian lives. Of course, a lot has been written about Ashoka for the past 100, 150 years. I was trying to find something new, a new angle, so to speak, to present Ashoka to a non-scholarly audience. Although I was writing from a deep reading of scholarship on Ashoka, the book is directed at the non-specialist, although I always hoped that the specialist also may have something useful to get from it. So the way I went about approaching it was to find out who Ashoka was from contemporary accounts. In other words, if people want to find out 200 years from now who Patrick Olliville is, they'll do two things. They'll read what I have written.
Right.
And they'll read what has been written about me. Definitely. By people who knew me, who are my contemporaries. That is the normal way of writing a biography. You look at the person's own work as well as what others around him who knew him say about him. With regard to Ashoka, we don't have the second part of this equation. We don't have contemporary accounts of Ashoka. Right. From people who knew him. We have accounts of Ashoka written 200-400 years later, mostly by Buddhists who gave a new personality to Ashoka as this great Buddhist king. Right? So So we have reflections and recreations of Ashoka's memory within the Buddhist community, which we cannot really be sure about in terms of historical accuracy. Unfortunately, many of the so-called biographies or writings about Ashoka have sometimes explicitly, sometimes not willingly, but just doing it, use these, what I call hagiographical accounts of Ashoka from centuries later. So I took a decision not to do that, but to look at Ashoka himself as he appears, his persona appears from his own writings, which is quite precious, because with regard to people in antiquity from around the world, we often have writings about the person, but not writings from the person. Even when we have writings such as the inscriptions of Persian kings, we can be sure that most of these inscriptions were eulogies, what we call in India prashastis, written about the king, rather than the words of the king himself. So we have this precious account of Ashoka because he wrote a lot. He says himself that he has written a lot. And some of his writings were reduced to inscriptions on stone, on rocks and in pillars. So what we have is something very precious from the ancient period, from around the world, but clearly very unique in India, where we have the king's own words exactly as they were written 2,300 years ago, right? So I thought of using that as an entree into his own person. We have a problem there because I as a biographer, let the person define himself. It's like somebody writing an autobiography, meaning writing about himself. There are ways in which I and others can safeguard against that pitfall. We can read between the lines. As I said, we can read about silences, what he doesn't talk about. There are many ways, but there is no countering the fact that the way I have approached this biography, I have let Ashoka speak through my writing to the public who is reading my book. Right? That is both the positive aspect of my book as well as the negative, because it does let Ashoka define himself.
Thank you for the answer. And one very important thing which you mentioned is that the later accounts of Ashoka, which were primarily written by Buddhists, paint him in a very hagiographical picture. So my second question is in relation with this. And for that, I will quote one very interesting line from your book, which says that Ashoka was not a Buddhist king, but a king who happened to be a Buddhist. So, please discuss Ashoka's relation with Buddhism in the context of past scholarship, as well as your own view that he was not a quote-unquote Buddhist king.
Yeah. So when I say he was not a Buddhist king, I'm saying that he did not use his role as king to promote Buddhism, to be an evangelist of Buddhism, the way many kings were in the past about religion. Because if you read all his inscriptions, there are three in which he presents himself as a Buddhist. The first is the very first inscription he left behind soon after his Kalinga War, and soon after he became, he says, an Upasaka, which is a Buddhist layman. And that is the first minor rock inscript edict that we call MRE1, minor rock edict 1. And there he speaks about himself as a Buddhist, and he uses Buddhist terminology. And it may well have been that he went down that path that is indicated in this very brief inscription, the very first that he wrote. He may well have been a Buddhist king, but at some point, as I tried to show in my book, he changed course. He went from proclaiming his Buddhism in public to charting a new course where he tried to develop a new philosophy, a new moral philosophy based on his own view of what dharma is. So he uses the term dharma, which was the term that was used during that time by a lot of religious organizations. But he gave it a new meaning as a moral concept. And if you look at all the other inscriptions that we find, all the rock inscriptions, all the pillar inscriptions, we don't find Buddhism presented in any way as something that people should follow. There are two inscriptions that where he becomes a Buddhist and he speaks as a Buddhist. And those two are addressed at the Buddhist monks. There's the Bhairat inscription, where he tells the Buddhist monks what to read, what are the best Buddhist scriptures, and the so-called schism edict, which deals with the internal discipline of a Buddhist monastery. Those are the only two that we have where he speaks as a Buddhist.
Thank you for the answer. To ask about Ashoka's policy, and Ashoka is a king, I would again quote a line from your book, which says that Ashoka was a penitent, but not a pacifist. So what do you think are the aspects of Ashoka as the pragmatic politician that we can find from his edicts? Because he is often painted as a person with high moral standards, with someone who preached moral values, but his life as a politician, as an emperor of a great empire, is often ignored. So what do you think about this?
Right, yes. So if you look at the very first major rock inscription, it talks about two kinds of killing that he says should not be undertaken. One is killing for religious purposes, ritual killing. We find in the Vedic sacrifice, the killing of animals, right? And we find killing of animals, I'm sure, in local folk rituals. He inveighs against that. Then he goes to what other kinds of killing human beings do, that is killing animals for food. And he says that and he confesses publicly that in his own kitchen, three animals were killed every day for the royal kitchen, right? But then he says, but we will not do that in the future. He sort of postpones that. So he's very honest about what he is doing, but he's also very honest about the fact that a virtue he calls vihisa, which later Indians know better as ahimsa, is a cornerstone of his moral philosophy, right? Now, from there, people have taken the second step, a leap, I would say, to say that so he would not engage in war, he would not engage in any kind of a killing of human beings, which are necessary to maintain order, to expand your realm, etc. Now, this you find in the 13th rock inscription, where he looks back with remorse about what happened in Kalinga, which is modern-day Orissa, Odisha, where he said hundreds of thousands of people were killed or died because of his war. And he says this weighs heavily on his mind. Right? So in a sense, what he's saying is that kings should not wage war, unnecessarily, because there he talks about, in that particular inscription, he talks about what we would call today forest people. People who lived in forests, they're called Atavikas. The Atavis were people who lived in the forest, therefore they were outside the control of a centralized government bureaucracy. They were always, throughout Indian history, sometimes viewed by the government as a thorn on their side. I'm sure it is. It had a different perception if you were looking from the Atavika's side, right? Atavika's side would have said, government is intrusive into our lives. But this is the government's view, right? So Ashoka presents this and he tells Atavikas to not kill. But he also says, but if you do, he says, in a sort of a tangential way, not directly, says, I'm still powerful. Know that I have power, right? So in a sense, he's saying, look, I would love to deal with you peacefully. Behave yourself. Do not kill, right? But if you do, I can come after you.
Right.
And then one thing is very clear that in his Pillar Inscriptions, he very clearly says that there was capital punishment as part of the judicial process in India of his time, right? And he says, for example, that he gave 3 days reprieve for a person who was condemned to death so that that person can prepare himself for the next life. So there was killing, there was judicial killing, there was possibly other kinds of killing. So there was no way you can run a huge empire as he did by completely being absent from using force, we would say today. Yeah.
And very interestingly, and this thing you also mentioned in your book, that he does not regret about waging a war against killing. He regrets about what happened in the aftermath, but he did not regret waging a war against killing.
Right. He never says that I'm sorry that I did this. Right. He's always sorry about what happened as a
right.
consequence of the war. And he also says, when he talks about this, he says, what we would call, I'm so sorry that so many innocent people were killed. Innocent people, meaning
right.
good people were killed, right? He's not worrying about all the people who were killed. He's not talking about how many soldiers he killed from the Kalinga side, right? He's talking about good people. So yeah, questions have been asked about why did he wage war against Kalinga? It was a small area. He could have done otherwise. Possibly there was some diplomatic ways in which he could have dealt. Maybe he tried and failed. Kalingas were proud people. They didn't want to succumb to that. And there must have been something in Kalinga that Ashoka and the empire thought that they needed. People have said it may be that major trade routes
yes.
went through that area. That's one thing. If you look at Kautilya's Arthashastra, many of the so-called best forest that produced the best elephants in India were also located in this part of the world.
Right.
Elephants were a major part of warfare during that time, right? So there would have been many economic and military reasons why he went against the Kalingas. Yeah.
Definitely. Thank you for the answer, sir. And to further our discussion about Ashoka's Dhamma, can you briefly explain to the audience what Ashokan Dhamma actually was and in what ways it was inspired by Buddhism or influenced by Buddhism, and in what ways it was different from the Buddhist doctrine of that time?
Yeah, so I deal with this somewhat in detail in the book. Look at the Panchashila, which is the sort of the distillation of the Buddhist lay ethic. Of those five, the only one that features prominently in Ashoka Dharma is not killing. Buddhists say Panatipata, the very first Panatipata, Veramani Sikka, Padang Samadhyami. That's the Pali way of saying that, right? So that's the none of the others. There's nothing about alcohol. There is nothing about sexual misconduct. There is nothing about stealing. You would think that a king writing to the people, these are important things. Theft is an important element of social cohesion and law and order, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is telling the truth. Yes, telling the truth occurs once or twice in his definition of Dharma, but not always. So you find that the very heart of the Buddhist lay ethic is not represented in Ashoka's. Ashoka's, I try to show with some diagrams too, how Ashoka's ethic, Ashoka's moral philosophy was very much relational ethic. How an individual, I call the self, myself, how I can live a dharmic life, and that life is lived by having a proper relationship with other significant people who are around me, my superiors, my elders, my parents, my equals, my friends, my relatives, My religious neighbors, the Brahmins and the Shramanas, right? People who are below me, my slaves and my servants, to have a proper relationship with that. So that's at the heart of it's almost a social ethic, but couched within an individual ethic, because it is regarding how I can develop proper relationships with others around me. So this is an interesting part, and this is something that you don't find in Buddhism. This is Ashoka's own invention, of his own morality, and he thought that this morality can be superimposed on all other kinds of morality that people of the time followed. Whether you are a Buddhist or a Jain or a Ajivika or a Brahmin, all of them had their own ethical systems. But he thought this was something like an umbrella that could go above them. So that's why I talk about, and I think your question that you were asking about what he envisioned this. And I'm thinking of it as what I call a civil religion, right? A religion that is above religions, but that gives a certain identity as what we would call today citizenship. As a citizen of the United States or a citizen of India, different people have different faiths and religions, but above that, as an Indian citizen, can we have a moral superstructure?
Right.
To which everybody to some degree, this is done by the civil and moral, civil and criminal codes of the country, which tells you you can't do this, you can't do that, right? That it sort of underpins a certain moral philosophy. But this he tries to do with his own preaching of this philosophy, right?
Right. Thank you for the answer and also elaborating upon your idea of civil religion of Ashokan Dhamma. So in relation with Ashoka's civil religion, as you think it was his actual Dhamma was, so what do you think was his objective behind pursuing this idea? Was the aim to make the society more moral and ethical, or was this idea inspired by a political acumen which could have helped Ashoka to govern over a vast empire that he controlled?
Yeah, I think both. I don't think that kind of thing, you need to choose one or the other. And you find that also in modern political discourse, when you have thought about civil religion. This was done especially in the United States, where John Kennedy talked about God, the various kinds of civil religion symbols that we have. That doesn't mean that you're not a Catholic or a Hindu you're all having different faiths, but about that, there is something. I think this is, of course, speculation. We cannot get into Ashoka's own mind, but I think what Ashoka is trying to do is he was a deeply religious man, and he wanted his subjects to be ethically sound individuals, following strong and deep ethical principles. And he says all the time, if you do that, you will not only be a good person in this life, but also go to heaven. Going to heaven is a recurrent theme. So he's thinking about after death, what will you do, right? What will happen to you? So that, I think, is an important part. But this is something he doesn't say, and we can surmise. He was also governing a very heterogeneous group of individuals and communities, going from what is today Afghanistan to what is today Bangladesh, from what is today southern Nepal to what is today Karnataka. Now, even today, with all the modern communications, imagine the diversity of languages, of food, of languages, of religions across this. So I think, like any good politician, he was trying to give a sense of belonging to these people. In other words, you are belonging to a unit that is larger than you, of which individual people around the country would have only a vague idea of what this Maurya Empire was.
Right.
Remember that there was no maps that could say, hey, this is the map, right? Yeah, this is Afghanistan, and you are over here. I mean, they haven't had a vague relationship. Of course, people knew because they traveled. Some people traveled, right? But the extent of this empire was vague, and you are belonging to it. And Ashoka says, "You are my children.
Yes.
If you are my children, we are a family. Who are the other members of my family?" Right? I mean, these are the kinds of questions that I think must have percolated in Ashoka's own mind, and that's what he's trying to do, I think.
Right. Thank you for the answer. And to continue with Ashoka's relation with his citizens, as you mentioned that he calls his people as his children. Do you think that Ashoka wanted to establish a more ethical, moral relationship with his subjects? And that is why he used metaphors like children and being a father to his subjects?
Yeah. So, it is a common thing, philosophers of sociologists, especially French sociologists, have talked about this. It's called the naturalization process. In other words, much of what we have in the world of human experience are contingent,
right,
meaning they are there, but they need not have been there, right? So, for example, if I say that the President of the United States has certain power over me, I'm a subject, right? But that is contingent. He can be thrown away at the next election and somebody else will come, right? Those are contingent relationships. But what happens with regard to royalty especially, because kings are not elected, kings don't have the majority of the people saying, yes, right? You rule because of my consent, right? Kings rule not because of the consent of the people, but because of something else. And the kings try to say what that something else is, right? Sometimes they say it is divine mandate. So the king is partly divine. He's not really human. You find this in Japan, right? The Japanese emperor. You find also in if you look at the Dharmashastra of Manu, it talks about the king being formed out of parts of the various divinities, right? So it's a divinity. That's one way of doing it, right? So the other way of doing it is like a family. So when you are a child, 5, 6, 7, 8, did you tell your father, how dare you tell me what to do? Where did you get your authority?
Definitely.
No, you just accepted it, right? There's something natural about a father's and a mother's relationship with the children, right? And the authority of the father and the mother are not questioned by the children. It's taken as natural. If you can transplant that into the larger field of politics and say the king is our father and we are his children, now we have established a particular kind of relationship between the political power and the subjects that the political power rules, which sort of what the sociologists would say naturalizes this relationship. This is not a contingent relationship. This is a natural relationship, like the relationship we have to natural entities in the world. We have to the sun and the moon and the trees. No, they're natural. We don't ask, how come the sun is over there? Why don't you have something else? No, these are part of the normal natural phenomena, and the easiest to understand for the people is to say, king is my father. And just as a father does everything for the benefit of the children, so the king will do everything for my benefit, right? You not only question his authority, but also you know that it is a beneficent authority. I gained by his authority. So that's, I think, what Ashoka does. And it's not something very peculiar to Ashoka. You find this throughout Indian history.
Right, definitely. Also, just to inform you, sir, because I don't have Zoom Premium, so this meeting will get over after 40 minutes. So I
Okay.
will share you the another link when this meeting gets over. We have still, I think, 10 minutes left with us in this meeting.
Okay.
So to thank you for the answer, and to further our discussion about Ashoka and his Dhamma. One, you mentioned that Ashoka, after a point of time in his career as a Buddhist layman, he pivots to Dhamma. So in the light of this statement, can you tell the audience about how Ashoka became an Upasaka or a layman, and what does pivoting of Dhamma mean, and how it is significant for Ashoka's relation with Buddhism?
So Ashoka himself says that he had been an Upasaka for 1.5 years when he went to visit the Sangha. Sangha means Buddhist monastic. And so the Sangha is a sort of an abstract concept. He went to visit the Sangha. Whom he visited? One monk, a group of monks, particular monastery, he does not say. But he said after that, he became dedicated and following it with intensity, right? There's an intensity, parakrama, he says. So that's the kind of effort that he had at the beginning. But he was a neophyte. He had just become a Buddhist. A few years later, we do not know how long, he then starts writing to the Buddhist monks. Where he's writing now as almost a Buddhist expert, himself a theologian, he has the audacity to tell monks, send the monks a reading list.
Right.
Basically telling, hey guys, it's like a teacher telling your students, right, over the summer, these are the 5 books you should read, right? He's telling the monks now, right? So it's a bit of audacity for a lay person to do that. But it appears that he had taken his Buddhism seriously. And he is now naming. This is the first time in the history of India that we find outside the Buddhist canon itself, statements about the titles of Buddhist scriptural texts, right? For the first time.
Right.
And he says, you should read this, 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 and this, right? All this. So questions can be asked. Did the monks have copies of these? Were these things written down or purely oral? When Ashoka says read them, how can they find them to read? So those are the kinds of questions that emerge from that. We do not know. The other one, where the schism really comes, he's being a ruler, he's telling his officials, if Buddhist monks don't behave themselves, if they create dissension, they should be expelled. Normally, within the Buddhist canonical rules, it is the Buddhist monks who get together and expel somebody from the community.
Right.
Nothing good from outside comes in. Now, here he's coming from outside. The king coming and saying, you are a disruptor, out you go. That's the kind of thing that he's trying to tell, right? So that is quite high-handed work. We do not know the subtext. Ashoka didn't get up one day and said, well, let me teach these Buddhist monks something. No, there must have been a subtext to that. What was happening in the monastery? What kinds of Buddhist monks had Ashoka's ear saying, Your Majesty, you have to do something about these people in this monastery, right? They are troublemakers. And he listened to them and said, something like that must have happened, right? But yes, so he became then a confirmed and a mature Buddhist. He must have, even by today's way we talk about, probably a Buddhist theologian. He fancied himself as a Buddhist theologian. Yeah.
Thank you for the answer, sir. To further talk about schismatic, because it is a very highly contested
I'm sorry, say that again.
schismatic of
Yes,
Ashoka,
ma'am. Yes.
which is very highly contested. So do you think that Ashoka actually interfered in the decision-making process of Sangha, and he sort of tried to control the functioning of Sangha? Or does this incident have a what do you call subtext to it, and there must have been different circumstances?
Yes, so as I said, yeah, there surely was a subtext to it, and we are not privy to that. We do not know. What it does say is two things. that it, he thinks is very, very important for the Sangha, for it to last, for it to thrive, to have unity, that there should not be dissension. Then I show in the book two instances where this happens. The word Sangha is used. Sangha is also a political confederation, besides being a Sangha of the Buddhists. And there is the Buddhist Ajatasattu, who sends his minister to the Buddha because he wanted to attack Lichavis, who are a Sangha, and there's the discussion about it. And Ashoka tells the minister, and then later tells the Buddhist monks, the same instruction, where if a Sangha sits down at the meetings, gets up from the meetings in unanimity. The word is samagra, or in Sanskrit, samagra, together as a whole, not having factions, then the Sangha will thrive. This is the thing that Ashoka is talking about too. That's the context in which Ashoka says you have to have samagra in the thing. But whether he tried to control the Buddhist monasteries other than this particular text, we do not know. We do not know. But it is very clear that the Buddhists of the time when he lived very much thought of Ashoka as a Buddhist king.
Right.
That he was in their corner. And that is why the whole hagiographical literature around. I have translated the book by Ashwa Ghosha called Buddha Charita. Buddha Charita is the life of the Buddha written by this monk around the first or second century after Christ. That's about 3-4 centuries after Ashoka. And interestingly, Buddha's life ends with Ashoka, not with the Buddha's death.
Right.
So that's because Ashoka, they think of as the final triumph of Buddhism, is Ashoka, right? So Buddhist memory always thinks of Ashoka as this, the Buddhist triumph in Ashoka. Right? I try to show that is probably not historically true, right? But that is at least the perception of the Buddhist.
So thank you, sir, for your very detailed answer. So my next question is about Ashoka's dharma diplomacy, which I personally found very interesting concept. So what was Ashoka's dharma diplomacy in context of his relations with his neighboring empires?
Yeah, so we get a very slight window into this, what I've called diplomatic dharma diplomacy. Interesting thing is that the Buddhist hagiographers are very clear about his outreach to neighboring countries with regard to Buddhism. Right? Not about the Dharma, but Buddhism.
Right.
Sri Lanka is very clear that Ashoka sent a sapling of the original Bodhi tree under which the Buddha gained enlightenment. And his two children, girl and a boy, became monks and nuns, and they came to Sri Lanka to preach Buddhism. So the Sri Lankan Buddhism establishes the direct link to Ashoka. Right? This is not at all confirmed by Ashoka's own writing. But what he does say is that he sent diplomats, dutas, to neighboring countries, especially of the Northwest, which are basically Greek kingdoms, in the aftermath of Alexander the Great's invasion of this area. When he died, his empire was divided up by his generals. So he sent these dutas to preach Dharma to them. And he says that even people where his dutas have not gone, have heard about it and converted to his Dharma. Now, whether this is pure hyperbole, probably it is, right? Maybe his ministers were feeding him a lot of things that he liked to hear, right? Even though, because from the Greek side, where we have a lot of information, a lot of writing of this period, we hear nothing about that from the other side, right? We hear from them. But the interesting thing he did was, and this is from history of religion, history of the spread of religion is very important, is that his ambassadors, his envoys, did not go empty-handed to these places. He said that he sent them medical knowledge and medical supplies and medical professionals. Somehow he had the idea, and this may have been true to some degree, that he had better medical knowledge and better medicines than anybody else in the world, right? So he said he thought his doctors were much better than the doctors elsewhere. And it may well be true that India developed what scholars have called a rational, reason-based medical philosophy and medical knowledge, not connected to the magical potions that often accompanies medicine in other parts of the world, even in India, right? So it may be. So that is very interesting that he sent all these. He sent basically plants, maybe seeds of trees, medicinal herbs, to these people. So that is an interesting part of this approach to the others. You remember when Christian missionaries came to various parts, they brought two things. They brought hospitals and schools.
Right.
That's what we have in India and other parts of the world. So there was one way in order to influence people. So yes, so he did that. But we can never be sure how successful he was. He never says where he sent this. He mentions four Greek kings from the northeast. Then the interesting part of this, as prompts me, your question prompts me, is that he dealt with these Greek kings very differently from the way he dealt with other people along his southern border, Sri Lanka, Kerala, Tamil Nadu, that whole area, right? He talks about these people by their ethnic names, Kerala Putra, no? Chola, Tamraparni, Sri Lanka, right? But with regard to the Greeks, he gives them names, real names, right? This may go well back. The good work has been done recently with regard to the way Ashoka's grandfather, Chandragupta, dealt with Seleucus, who was the successor to Alexander, and what scholars have called the Indus Treaty, whether the treaty between them. So in a sense, what they're doing is they were recognizing each other as independent rulers. And Ashoka, I think, inherited that way of thinking about the Greek kings as his peers, his friends, you know, over there. But the, down south, he just calls them by their ethnic names, right? So that's the very interesting. And you must also realize that in Afghanistan, which was part of the Greek world at the time, he translated his text into Greek.
Yes.
And wrote it in Greek script over there, right? So right. This is giving them a kind of special treatment that he didn't in the south. Right. When he wrote his inscriptions in Karnataka, he did not use a southern language. He did not translate his text into a southern language.
He just translated the text into Greek.
Yeah.
Very interesting. To talk about Ashoka's Dhamma more, sir, you mentioned one important thing, that Ashoka remains silent about certain aspects of Buddhism and certain aspects of his social conditions. So how do you think his silence, Ashoka's silence in his edicts and his inscriptions are significant in terms of how India looked at that time period and in terms of how Buddhism was in that time period?
Yeah. So I think historians have not fully appreciated how important silences are in terms of historical knowledge, right? In other words, it is as important to know what you don't talk about than what you actually talk about, because there is always a reason why you don't talk about something. There could be two reasons. One is you don't know about it. In other words, you didn't think about saying it because you don't know. And the other thing is that You're trying to suppress it. You don't want to talk about it. That's not something you want to highlight, right? So the issue with regard to Buddhism is that Ashoka hardly ever speaks about any Buddhist, central Buddhist concept that we know from other sources, right? So the issue is, why didn't he? The Four Noble Truths, right? Which is supposed to be the central part, various other central part. He doesn't deal with that. Was it because he didn't know? Or was it because he didn't think it was important enough to be said out loud to ordinary people? We do not know. So that's the important part of it. And scholars have, some have surmised that it may be that Buddhism of this period did not have these kinds of doctrinal positions. Difficult to understand that because these are so central that you know, a couple of centuries after the Buddha, they still would not have the Four Noble Truths. You know? So that's very unlikely. Then there is the, for me, the more interesting part is his silence with regard to what we think we know about ancient India. I say we think we know because we get our information, almost all our information, from certain kinds of literature. And those kinds of literature are all written by Brahmins, having a particular axe to grind, having a particular political, social philosophy to espouse, to present, right? Ashoka, for example, does not speak about the Varna system that I talk about, right? The four Varnas, which we take as a matter of course to be how ancient society in India was organized. Then we had to ask the question, was it? Or was it purely a Brahmanical presentation, an ideology rather than a social reality? Did people during Ashoka's time go about answering a question? If I ask, who are you, to a person of Ashoka's time, did he immediately answer, I'm a Kshatriya? Probably not. Even in later medieval India, people did not identify themselves simply with caste markers. So the issue, of course, is why was he silent with regard to these social categories? But Shudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, the names don't occur at all. So that is very interesting. One way to say is that he didn't have an occasion to talk about. But he did. Why? Because he was talking, as I said earlier, about relationships. And if those relationships are social, then relationships across varnas, across caste, was also an important part of a social ethic. Right? But he doesn't talk about that at all. So that, I think, is an interesting part. There are other things he doesn't talk about, which are more difficult to talk. He doesn't talk about rebirth. He doesn't talk about the karma theory. These are central aspects of all religions that came from what is today Bihar, right? Magadha area. Professor Johannes Bronckhorst had written about how distinctive this area was in terms of these kinds of philosophical religious doctrines. And he doesn't talk about it at all. Why? Maybe he didn't want to talk about it or didn't have an occasion. I mean, he always talks about heaven. If you do these things, you'll go to heaven. If you do these things, other things, you will not go to heaven, right?
Right.
What happens after death? But theory of rebirth would have given him even greater ammunition to tell people to be good, right? Because right. You can be born as a pig or a worm, right? I mean, those are very real things, right?
Right?
Heaven is sort of abstract out there kind of thing, right? But he doesn't do that. He doesn't do that. So this is an interesting question. I mean, you must realize our sources are limited, so we cannot answer adequately all the questions we have
right. Or
we think about when we read these things. So we have to be humble about it, saying that there are certain questions we cannot answer.
Right. Thank you for the answer, sir. One very significant feature of Ashokan Dhamma or Ashokan Edicts is that he constantly emphasizes on not quarreling with other sects or Pashandas. So how do you think ecumenism is a unique phenomena in Ashokan Dhamma? And putting in the context of ancient India, how unique it becomes and how distinctive it becomes.
Yes, I think in the context of ancient India, and in fact, to a degree in the context of ancient world, globally, Ashoka is unique in this particular way, right? That he tries to rise above factional differences within religion. I said earlier that his dharma stood above the Vedas. But then he comes down and says, how are you going to manage the relationships between these various religious organizations? The word he uses is pasanda, right? Pasandas are, the term pasanda occurs for the first time in Indian history in Ashokan inscriptions. After that, we find it used in many places, often as a pejorative. Pasanda describes the other, not me. Right. I'm not a pasanda, you are a pasanda, right? That kind of a thing. Both the Buddhists and the Jains, to a lesser degree, and certainly the Brahmins, use the term differently. Ashoka used it as a purely, as a pure term of classification. It's a classificatory term. So that's, in other words, it's like very similar to the way we use as scholars the word religion, right? There are many religions. People belong into those religions. So Pasandas were demographic groups. And he says that this demography included both those who have gone forth, the Pravrajita, meaning a professional religious class who were wandering, who didn't have homes, and Grihastha, one who remained at home. So the domiciled people. And he's trying to tell these people to behave kindly and appropriately with each other, especially, I think, with regard to dharma. If you think of dharma as truth, if you think of it as truth, he's trying to say nobody has a full grasp of dharma. The way we can get a full grasp of dharma is by talking to each other, relating to each other, learning from each other. So he uses the word, interesting word in Sanskrit, bahu shruta. Bahu shruta in Sanskrit means many or much. Bahu shruta, heard, much heard. A much heard man in English translation is a learned man, right? In English, we have, especially in the British English, you have a well-read person. When you go to Oxford, you read philosophy, they say, right?
Right.
Read here is translated in India of listening, because the books were not there to read, but people over there to listen to, right? So Bahushruta. You can't become a Bahushruta, he says, by listening to yourself and to others who repeat the same thing. You have to expand your horizons, listen to other people, and learn from them. So that's a, it's a, it's a, it's a very modern concept, right? And no doubt it died with Ashoka. I mean, you don't hear about it again afterwards.
Right.
So that's an interesting aspect. It emerges later in the 20th century when the Indians wanted to write a constitution and they used the term secular, not in the Western sense of the word, secularism, but in the sense that secular means a structure, a constitutional structure that is above and beyond the different religions that you have. So the state does not have an investment in any of the religions. That is the first time, I think, that this is reimagined, Ashokan. Maybe a little bit, as some people have said, in the Akbar's time, where you find a similar ecumenical, you know, outreach.
Thank you for the answer, Dr. Olivelle. And while I was reading about Ashoka, I read some works of Romila Thapar, and she has argued that Ashoka in the later part of his reign shows signs of megalomania in regards with his Dhamma. So do you think that later on Ashoka emphasized excessively on his Dhamma, and this even subsided his concern for Buddhism? Do you find this obsession or megalomania in his
work? Yeah, I personally would not, I hate to disagree with Professor Thapar, who is a great scholar and a good friend. It is clear that in the pillar inscriptions, which were written in the 26th year of his reign after his consecration. And the last one, the seventh, in the 27th year, that would have been about 7 or so years before he died. So he's writing here as an old man. There's a certain nostalgia, certain looking back. It's almost like a review of what he had done, and maybe regrets about what he has failed to do. He tried but failed, kind of thing. And in that sense, there is a certain different flavor to what he's saying. I would not characterize it as megalomania in the sense, because it has such a like total egoism, you know, sort of putting yourself in the center. But it is clear that his earlier writings, which are found in the so-called major rock inscriptions, have a less self-obsessed presentation. He's talking about things out there in the world of people and how he wanted. The only place where he talks about regrets and what happened is in the 13th, where he talks about Kalinga, right? So it is a... So yes, there is a certain certain distinct flavor. One could call it an obsession if you think of it as a not totally negative, but something that you are all the time talking about, right? You're obsessed with that kind of thing.
Right.
And that's all I can say about that. Yeah.
So thank you for the answer, sir. And well, we have already taken a lot of your time. So I would just take a remark from you on, I would want to ask you that how much we can see or not see Ashoka in the legacy of Indian history, how we can see his legacy in Indian history.
Yeah, right. So if you think of Indian history as also Buddhist history, because Buddhism was very much part of India, then yes, quite a lot. A lot of Buddhists wrote books on Ashoka, but always from a Buddhist perspective. It wasn't a dispassionate account of what he did, right? It is interesting that in all the writings of Buddhists about Ashoka, they never refer to the fact that he wrote so many inscriptions. Nothing about it. That's remarkable, right? The main source of information we have about Ashoka, they just completely ignore or didn't know about it. So that's the interesting part. But if you go beyond the Buddhist, there is literally nothing. There are mention of Ashoka in the Puranic list of dynasties, but that's just a name. That's all. Ashoka comes. Then there are some inscriptions, such as that of Rudradaman in about 150 AD, where he writes in Girnal, right below the Ashoka's own inscriptions, and refers to him. Ashoka. So 150 plus 200. So that's 350, almost 350, 400 years, 350 years after Ashoka. Memory of Ashoka is still there. This local king, you know, writing. And he knew that this particular lake had been built by the Mauryas and and expanded by Ashoka. So these are in it. But then around this time, around the early centuries of the Common Era, the script in which Ashoka wrote became unintelligible. So Chinese monks come to India from about 300 to 700 AD, you know, the Common Era. And they go and they see these Ashokan pillars. And they say people there or some tour guide of the time, right?
Right.
Told these monks what it says. It had just made up naturally. They could not read it. They just say what it. So until but the fact that these pillars had significance, and maybe even a memory that they were done by Ashoka continued. Samudragupta, during the Gupta period, writes his inscription under Ashoka's inscription. So he knew that this was important. Then In the Middle Ages, 12th century, I think, the Muslim rulers actually physically take this and takes it to Delhi, right? And that was quite an engineering feat to take that and not break it, right? So there was that thing. But it was, you know, only in the second half of the 19th century when princeps finally deciphered the letters of this, that real scholarship began about Ashoka and his writings. So it is only in the late 19th, then of course in the 20th century, that you find Ashoka being rediscovered. And that's the Ashoka that Nehru read about.
Thank you for the answer, sir. And I think we should I should just ask you about your future or upcoming research works that the audience might be interested in. So if you want to tell something.
Well, no, I don't have a particular. I have several research projects going on, which are much more philological, manuscript based, and that's a thing. I will do something about Ashoka again, but in the probably not for a year or so. Yeah.
So
Thank you very much
I
for.
think we should stop the interview here. Thank you very much, Dr. Oliver, for accepting our invitation and giving your time to New Books Network. It was a great pleasure hosting you. Thank you very much, and we wish you all the best for your upcoming projects and endeavors. Thank you very much.